Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the brand new We Have the Internet On
Yay!
Supertone Show.
Woo-hoo! 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Modern Lovers and Roadrunner Once. And that was released as a single and as part of their eponymous, highly acclaimed debut album in 1976 on the Berserkly record label.
Well, Jonathan Richman.
Yes.
There's so many versions of that song, though. And the one I sort of remember is that there's a lot more, seems to be a lot more confusion in the backing vocals. They all sound very drunk. And radio.
And, oh, and, yeah.
And the guitars look clean. But this has got a lot higher energy. than some of the other versions. It's a bit faster, and it's sort of, you know, but it's a great song.
It is weird, you know, because this version is produced by the Berserkly label boss, who's called Matthew King Kaufman. But they first recorded this song back in 1972, which is and it was produced by John Cale of the Velvet Underground.
Indeed.
So it is a bit confusing because there's so many different versions of it, and each version has a different feel to it. But I like this one, but it's a rock and roll standard. I mean, it's a classic, isn't it, in terms of proto-punk, apparently.
Oh, I know. Proto-punk, proto, oh, proto-everything. I don't know. Proton. I'm sick of proto stuff, you know. But, you know, regardless of whether it's proto or not, it's a great... But it's virtually just one chord, you know.
Yeah.
And except when it does that five run, oh, do do do, and then back to the, you know.
It sounds like lads who don't wash very often, doesn't it? It's a song made by those guys with their pants halfway down there.
Well, I'm not sure whether Jonathan Rich would be very happy about that. It's probably very clean. But the Modern Lovers, I mean, was it Laura Barton? What did she have to say about it? Because she's a Guardian columnist, and she's very...
This is lovely, actually, because we're friends with Laura on Facebook, aren't we? And professionally. And I always love to read her work. It was saying here when I read reading up about it that in addition to being ranked number 269 on the 500 greatest songs of all time, Guardian journalist Laura Barton has described Roadrunner as one of the most magical songs in existence. And back in 2007, she wrote an essay published in the newspaper about her attempt to visit all the places that were mentioned in the song.
It's all right.
How cool is that, though?
Johnny Rotten actually liked this as well, and he doesn't like music either.
No. I hate music, but Roadrunner's my favourite song.
Yeah, it's... But there's something very basic about it. And I can understand when people say it's like proto-punk, because it is very trashy.
I don't know what that means, but carry on.
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, pre-punk.
Trashy.
Yeah, but it's just a trashy, and it's a great song. And a great hook, you know, played by just blokes in a garage.
Tell me what I say right now. Tell me what I
No, there's no more. Ray Charles, What I'd Say, Part 1 and 2 from his first studio album, What I'd Say, released on 19th of October 1959 on Atlantic Records, mixed by the remarkable Tom Dowd and recorded and written by Ray and produced by Amit Edrigan and Jerry Wexler.
Atlantic Records, baby.
Yeah. Well, this was prompted, wasn't it, by that last night we watched the Tom Dowd
documentary
again. He died in 2002, you know, I've forgotten it was that long ago.
I know, it was a bit of a shock, actually, when I saw that.
Yeah.
I loved it. It was so, do you know, the more we watch it, the more it just becomes part of us. I don't know. It just feels so home. What
Tom,
a guy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he worked with everybody. He worked with Clapton, he worked with Franklin a lot, he worked with Cream, he worked with, you know, of course, Ray Charles, the Allman Brothers. He was a de facto standard in American recording techniques, you know, because he was using an 8-track recorder. That's what we were watching last night. This is in the early 60s. So he was using 8 tracks and he was using it with, it might have even been on this record actually.
It was.
Because he got the idea off Les Paul. Les Paul had an 8-track recorder and they
bought
The
Octopus and the Monster or something.
That's right.
I remember that. Woo!
And Tom actually Atlantic ordered one after seeing Les Paul's, you know. So he was using 8-track, and he developed the slider fader. And
yeah, because before it used to be this big round knobs, didn't it?
Yeah.
And you just couldn't reach them all. So he found these slider faders, so you can actually just your fingers close. You can play it like a piano.
Yeah.
Which changed everything.
It did. And it's amazing, you know. And what I love about this record, the first thing I love is that Ray Charles, you cannot not love that sound.
Yeah.
It is the sound of blues. It is the sound of rock and roll. And what do they say? That he took biblical or church sounds and church music and put the devil's lyrics
to it.
That's
right, yeah, yeah. Complete controversial.
And there's a lot of Ray Charles in that documentary last night. And there's one thing that, you know, every time I listen to it, it always motivates me and always makes me believe that we're doing the right thing with what we do with the Starlight Campbell Band and anybody else that we produce. Ray Charles is sat there in his very dramatic style, you know. He's like, he's got a lot of style, isn't he, Ray? And he says, man, you can have 90 tracks, but what does it sound like, baby? What does it sound like? And that's right.
Yeah.
It's the sound, it's everything. It doesn't matter whether you've got one mic, a million mics. It really doesn't make any difference. It's what does it sound like? What emotion does it give? And there, they were clearly having a time. They were having a real good time. All that shouting and screaming at the end and the girls coming in, you know. And what else? You know, it's just great. And he captured that energy with very low amount of technology, really, because, you know, and the drummer was great. It's just a great. And that the sound of that Wurlitzer, it's an old valve. Wurlitzer, one of the first ones.
Well, I love that sound.
Well, we've got the Wurlitzer, but it's a more modern, it's an early 70s house, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, you know, it sounds similar to that, but there you can hear it crunchy because the valves are, you can hear it, it's just crunchy, you know. It's a fantastic sound.
Well, what was really beautiful, though, is that if you've got Tom there and he's just got this 8-track recorder, and one thing that really puts this into context is that George Martin, Tom Dowd had used an 8-track recording facility for 10 years. And George, and when he met George Martin, he was still using 3 or 4 tracks.
That's right.
So they didn't know, the Beatles didn't know, and George Martin didn't know that Tom Dowd had been using 8 tracks for 10 years. Well, so like with Tom, when and this is something I've just found out about now because I was just doing a bit more research. Because, you know, you get into stories and you've only got so much time.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, in between. But they were saying that a song before this had been banned because it was a little bit controversial. So it was Tom Dowd that came up with the idea of splitting the song into parts 1 and 2. And they had to do just a little bit of overdubs because they were a little bit dubious on some of the call outs and stuff.
Okay.
Because they didn't want it to be banned. But this ended up being his first chart pop. He crossed over. It was his first pop hit.
Yeah.
It earned him his first gold record. And they were saying something about that he kind of began the beginning of soul.
Well, you know, it's right. And Atlantic were just brilliant at producing black music, wasn't it? Because they were really into it. And they were doing it commercially. They weren't doing it for the goodness of their health, but they saw a gap in the market. But what they did, it gave the black musicians a platform to record and play, you know. And it's amazing at what they did. And I've got to say, it's my favourite label. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I love those guys, Wexler and Armgren. And, you know, it's as much almost as I love Olympic Studios.
It's weird, isn't it? But it's just, because I think it's there's real people, and the people are there actually loved the music and had relationships with people. And when Atlantic had their offices, it was an office by day and a recording studio at night, because they when they first started out.
Yeah, they put the desks on top of each other so they had enough room. But it's this level of inspiration that really gets me. And we watched Land Wild film recently. We watched that, the Tom Dade one. We've watched a few, haven't we? And they're really great, you know, as for all musicians, really, producers and creatives and everybody who's really interested in music. It's it's a great documentary. You should watch it.
Cool.
David Bowie. Who else could it be? And Cat People Putting Out Fire. And that was the title song from the 1982 film Cat People, released as a single in March 1982 on the MCA record label. Now, that version comes from the Let's Dance album. But I wanted to tell you about the original version, because the reason why he had to re-record it, this was released on MCA Records.
Right.
And when he wanted to put it on his Let's Dance album, MCA would not license it to EMI America, so he had to re-record it.
Blimey.
So on this version, and I want to talk about this one because this really took off. It reached number 26 in the UK. This is the original film version, which is very different. We've just had a listen to it as well.
Yeah.
And it's much more deeper voice and very more dramatic. It's much more dramatic.
Yeah.
And it's slower tempo.
Yeah.
But the song just went wild. It was number 13 in Canada. It was number one in New Zealand for 3 weeks. In Sweden, it was number one for 4 weeks. And Norway, a mighty 7 weeks. I mean, the song really, really connected. And MCA released it as a single 3 times that year.
Well, the glorious thing is, now we've got the internet. Could we onto the internet for a month in the house?
It's so most amazing.
We've had to do all the shows. We've had to go out to cafes and actually do all the research. And I haven't been able to look up, and we've not been able to look up.
So no.
I think the content's not been quite as good over the past 3 weeks. And so I apologise, but there's nothing we can do about it, really. It's as it is. But on the original version, David Bowie, Giorgio Moroder produced it.
Exactly, yeah.
And he co-wrote it or wrote it.
Yeah.
With Michael Landau on guitar, Leland Sklar on Gaith, and Keith Forstie, who is Giorgio Moroder's drummer, standard drummer, are playing there. And then, of course, this one from Let's Dance, it was Carmen Ross on bass, Omar Hakim, Nile Rodgers, Steve Ray Vaughan, of course, Rob Sabino, Temi Fuero, and Frank Sims. And backing vocals. But the great thing is, listening to both of them back to back, is that Moroder, you can hear that sort of rear electronic sort of thing going on, a very heavily processed.
Yeah.
But this, you know, has the Let's Dance drums, hasn't it? It's got that sound. And Stevie Ray Vaughan, I mean, what a delightful thing to be able to do, to play over a track like that and just be able to blow all over the track, you know, because he's basically playing all the way through it solo. That's what he's doing, you know?
Yeah, I think he found, David Bowie said that he saw Stevie Ray at a festival in Switzerland, I think, and he just blew him away and he was just like, right, I've got to work with you. And apparently Stevie didn't really know David Bowie's work much at the time. Mm. They just talked a lot about his band and that was it. And
he
just got in there.
Well, it broke Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Yeah, it did, didn't it?
Because he went massive after that. And you can tell it's him. I think he sounds a bit thin on that, to tell you the truth. But anyway, I think it's probably just a mix. But it's, you know, great guitar playing, great song, great vocal. And of course, Nile Rodgers, great production on that record. Even though it's sort of very, it's of its time, you know. It's
true.
Not sort of a normal thing, is it, where we have really rich sounds. It's obviously been heavily processed. Because on China Girl and Let's Dance, I know what they did is that they actually sampled a snare drum from an old country and western record.
Yeah.
And then, like, just changed the pitch of it and stuff and used that and sampled, of course. So, but Omar Hakim, what a drummer. My goodness, mate.
One thing I found out, which I haven't put on the notes actually, was that here's a question for you. You know, over the years, we hear stories of people like, say, Neil Young making decisions by not going on tour, and it's all about the music.
Yeah.
So, and it's really difficult because music is about relationships, but you need to sometimes try something different. I mean, and also, Bowie was trying to keep his mass audience that he was getting with this as well. And I think, and originally, Tony Visconti was going to produce Let's Dance.
Is that right?
And do you know how he found out?
Go on.
Well, Nile Rodgers was in the studio for a couple of weeks and he got a phone call from, I think, his secretary just saying, sorry, he's been working with Nile Rodgers and we don't want you anymore.
Oops.
I know. And it's a difficult one because apparently, well, obviously it did affect their relationship for about, it didn't work together again for about 20 years.
That's
but
right.
Anyway, they healed. But this is what I was thinking about this, because I know people who've worked with David Bowie, and you want to make the right decisions. And I know sometimes I can be called the tempo queen when I go, no, it's too fast, or, you know, because it's like you can't rest with a song and you, all you're trying to do is get the best, to get the song to feel right, and it's really, really difficult. But when he met Nile Rodgers, this is what I like, and he showed him a photograph of Little Richard in a red suit getting into a bright red Cadillac, and he told Nile, he said, Nile, darling, That's what I want my album to sound like. You're listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was David Sylvian and Richie Sakamoto forbidden covers from the Nagishi Ashima directed film Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. I wish you'd back announce as well. Also known as Furio, and was released as a single in 1983 on Virgin Records and also the film's soundtrack album. And you love it, don't you?
I do. I've got this little 7-inch and I fell in love with it as soon as it was released. And my younger sister Lorna scratched it.
No.
Oh, yeah. I was very upset. Because you know when you love vinyl.
It's your birthday today as well.
I know. Happy birthday, sis. It's really funny. I always remember this, like, you scratched my record. But I don't know what happened. As soon as I heard this song, I was mesmerised. The emotion, just the feel, is just so, it's so, so beautiful. Just, it puts me into a bit of a trance.
Well, Sakamoto, I mean, he's a great composer, and he basically played everything on this, and David Sylvian wrote the lyrics and sang. Of course, he was in Japan, the band Japan.
Yeah.
Which was, obviously very topical at the time. And David Bowie's in the film, bit of a connection there as well.
I know, it was a bit interesting, really, because they were saying when they sort of built this set on this island, and the director was actually, Nagisa, he'd be very hands-on with all the other actors. And when it came to David Bowie and Tom Conti, who was in the film as well, It was just like, just do what you do. Fantastic.
Well, it's a great film as well. It's a long time since I've watched it. We should watch it again, actually.
Mm. And also, Rio Ricci actually starred. He was acting in the film as well.
That's right, yeah.
And he was saying that for that month when they were on location, he was hanging out with David Bowie every night, but he didn't have enough courage. He was too polite to actually ask him if he wanted to help work on the soundtrack with him.
Well, I'll tell you, the thing is, what really makes me sick about it is that he looks so cool. This is Sakamoto.
Yeah,
he's the coolest looking mother
he's
in the whole
dude,
world.
He's a dude, isn't he?
Yeah, and as he's getting older, he's looking cooler. And that is just outrageous, you know, so we don't like that at all. That's a reach it, you need to get your hair cut and all that.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Okay, anyway. He won a BAFTA for best film music for this, actually, for this film, which is fantastic. And what I love about him is that he's managed to translate and bring through his cultural music. You can feel it. But he's managed to take that into other cultures as well. And it's because it's sometimes you can get, you can't cross over.
Well, there's all the way through that, of course. It's like a Japanese version of the Claves.
And
then loads of reverb, like 80s, 90s reverb. But it's a great selling record. And I think the thing is about what we do, though, is that we take influences from everywhere. I think people are very surprised when they listen to us talking and us playing, because this is really our music. It's stuff that we've got in our vinyl collection. And we have a broad church of styles, don't we, in terms of what we listen and what we write.
I think it's about emotion for us, though, and stories, isn't it? And it's like it's passing on those stories and collating them from life experience, and music so powerful. It's intoxicating.
Yeah, and I think certainly this next record, I mean, I think it's going to be a bit more complex than Blueberry Pie in a way, but it's still, I want to try and keep those quintessential elements of just a few instruments without using a lot of different stuff, because it'd be very easy for us to get into orchestral and all that sort of stuff, wouldn't it? You know, the way we think about stuff, but...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But I think by limiting the amount of instruments that you're using on a record, it sort of gives you a sound, you know. What does it sound like, baby?
fish out on the line. I can reel you in. Most any time I got my brand on you. I got my brand on you. There ain't nothing you can do. I got my brand on you.
Alexis Corner's Blues Incorporated featuring Cyril Davis on vocals and I Got My Brand On You from the album R&B from the Marquee. Released in November, way back when in 1962 on Decca Records.
The first British blues record, this?
The first.
The first one ever recorded in England. Now, the reason why I know quite a lot about this at the moment is the fact I'm reading the book on Cream. It's called Cream. And it's talking about Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker, how they got together and all that sort of stuff. It's very interesting. And Alexis Corner was the instigator and the focal point of blues transitioning from all the things that had basically just gone before, you know? And he really kicked it off. And everybody was hanging out at his joint. You know, it was Mick Jagger. There was, well, basically everybody who was anybody, who was going to be anybody, hung out at this club.
This is so weird. Now, what was going on? Because when you look at it, so Cyril Davis and Alexis Corner actually opened up their own jazz club.
Correct.
Blues club, yeah. Called the London Blues and Barrel House Club in 1954. Because they used to be in a Chris Barber's jazz band or something.
That's right.
And they embraced touring musicians, had a lot of American artists in, didn't they?
They did.
Right? So they started the band in 1961. But when you look at, when they started like a jam thing, didn't they? Like an R&B kind of blues jam.
And everybody used to just turn up, you know?
Yeah, but when you look at it, you go, who turned up? They all did.
Yeah, everybody.
Like, you're talking like Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
Jack Bruce.
Yeah.
The lot.
Ginger Baker was playing drums.
Eric Clapton.
Yeah. The whole shebang. So, you know, when we say that we are, you know, British blues, this is where really it all started. Charlie Watts, yeah. But Charlie Watts gave up his place to Ginger Baker because he thought Ginger Baker was a better drummer. True. But it's a very odd book, actually. It's very oddly written, but I'm playing my way through it. And this was actually not recorded live at the Marquee at all. It was recorded at Decca Records.
Exactly.
In the studio, yeah. So, but it does sound authentic, because what Corner was really interested in was getting that authentic sound of the American blues, you know?
Yeah.
And I think they've kind of got it, but in a funny way, it's not. It's sort of, it's just got a twist to it that is distinctly British. And I think it's the recording, you know? I do think it's recorded, and the fact it rains a lot in London and very cold.
You reckon?
Well, I don't know yet. I know it's like that in Chicago.
That's a really
banana
comment to make.
No, but but what I'm saying is the fact that you know, Lanois often talks about his experience in New Orleans, going back to, you know, my favourite views in the world, and he said, you know, that the whole feel of it, the music coming out the buildings and everything, the smells, the heat, the whole thing contributes to the music, and you know, and I think that London, it does change, and the UK does change the way people feel about music and how they perform.
Yeah, it's a little bit harder. I mean, the thing is we found that when we're living in warmer climates, you're less productive. A lot of people were. I mean, the main thing is for us, though, we carried on working, didn't we? And we didn't get to see the sun half as much as we could do, but it's blinking hot. But
talk about blinking hot. We're in Germany at the moment. It's absolutely fantastic.
Oh, do you know what? I'm so happy. Where we're setting the studio up here, it's just, the feel's right.
Yeah.
The feel is so right. And as soon as we got here, the music starts flowing, we're writing together, and we're alive. I just feel totally and utterly in a state of wow.
Well, after 2.5 years, we've actually finally managed to get a studio. Just waiting for a new console at the moment to make itself known to us, which we'll get. And then, you know, and then we're going to do the next record. But it is very inspirational here. And that's why I've been watching a lot of these films. And we love doing this show, don't we? Because we listen to stuff and it always sparks our imagination. And we always start thinking a lot more creatively about stuff. And it's a cool thing hanging out with your wife and listening to music and talking about it. What a great thing to do. Alice Cooper, Elected, released as the first Hot 100 hit on their sixth studio album, Billion Dollar Babies, in September 1972, released on the Warner Brothers record label. I love Alice Cooper.
Why?
Well, you know, he flew in the face of everything that I'd known as a rocker, really. And because everybody thought he was like some sort of gay icon, and then he was horror, and it was like just a completely odd thing. And, you know, seeing him, because he's very American, you know, he's a very American rock and roll star. And as a young British guitar player, you know, I think, wow, you know, it's really odd and very, you know. And the subject matter, you know, never changes. I Want to Be Elected, absolutely fantastic, great lyric. And he's, but he's known really off stage as well as like a very witty and engaging guy. And
yeah,
and
that's what
because
I heard.
You know, when you see him and he's like, you know, he's got all guillotines and fake blood everywhere and all that, you know, he's like huge stage shows, which are legendary, you know?
Yeah.
He's actually a great guy. And the thing that I always think with him is that great scene in Wayne's World too, when he's when they go backstage and they fall to his feet, you know, and they go, we're not worthy, and they ask him about Milwaukee, and he said, do you come here often? And he sort of goes into the fact of how Milwaukee is pronounced this, that, and the other in Native American, and you know, it's just a great scene in that film. And I think that shows a little indication of what he's really like, you know? But anyway.
That's a boys' film, and I don't watch boys' films.
Yeah, I think Wayne's World. It's very funny.
I didn't think it was very funny, but then I watched it when it came out.
Yeah.
I don't think it got to... That was the two, was it? Anyway. Yeah, but it's interesting because these guys, there's more to them than the image that they portray. Isn't it funny? Because you know that he's supposed to be a really lovely guy, as you say, very engaging.
Absolutely.
But I didn't know that his real name's Vincent.
Yeah, that's right.
Fantastic. Vincent Damon Furnier, born on the 4th of Feb 1948. And then he changed his name after the band or something in the 1970s. And began a solo career in '75 with his concept album "Welcome to My Nightmare."
Well, the other interesting thing about the band as well—they were all inducted into the Hall of Fame, you know, which is incredible. And Glenn Buxton, who's the lead guitarist, you don't really hear of. He was—they said he was one of the top 100 greatest guitarists of all time, and this is Rolling Stone magazine. I'd never really heard of him, you know, and it's like odd. But, you know, the massive, this band, you know, in the United States. And it was only a few times that they really hit the British charts, wasn't it?
I tell you what, I've started to realise more and more as we do the shows and as you start to hear stories from other people, it's like, it's really important, actually. You know, a lot of the time people get on because they're good people and they're charming and they walk into a room and they know how to talk to people and make you feel good when you're chatting to them. I mean, this myth about, oh, you know, you're the attitude of who are you? You're below me. It doesn't exist because people, not as much. I mean, when you're really, really famous, I mean, I think the really, really famous people are just as, it's the people somewhere on the way up that get to be a little bit pigs, really.
Well, I met Elton John, you know, and he's a really cool guy. He's a lovely bloke. He's just a normal bloke, and you just don't, you know, realise it. And I tell you who's a real great gentleman of rock as well, and that's Nick Cave.
Ah.
And he's really very, very articulate, you know, and he's very good with his fans, and he's lovely. So, you know, more power to these sort of guys and girls, you know. Great.
This the same old ending. us in its face. Somehow it's lying there, brings a stillness to the air. Though man-made light at night is very bright, there's no whitewashed victim as the neon's dim to the coat of white.
Genesis. The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway from their sixth studio album of the same name, and it was released on the 18th of November in 1974 by Charisma Records.
Now, we haven't talked about bass for a bit.
No.
And there's the bass on this. Mike Rutherford, who also plays double neck, a bass and sometimes a 12 or 6-string guitar.
Right.
But here, he sounds very much like Chris Squire. He's got that very distorted sort of bass sound. And I thought it was very complex. And matched in with the excellent Phil Collins on drums. Because Phil, yeah, I mean, he's a fabulous drummer, Phil Collins.
Of course,
you know?
He is, yeah.
And this was the last album that Peter Gabriel recorded before they actually, well, he left, you know, Gabriel left, and they had to replace him with Phil Collins on vocals, of course.
It was interesting, you know, that time, because they'd just been on tour, and Peter Gabriel came up with the concept for the album, which was centred around a self-discovery of a character called Rael, a Puerto Rican youth living in New York City. And so he wanted to write all the lyrics for it. And so that kind of created some tension in the band. Then he went left. They were at Headley Grange as well for a few months.
Is that right?
Yeah, and they turned up, and it was in a really, really bad state. Like, there was stuff that should be in the toilet that was on the floor, and there were vermin and stuff, and it was just horrible. So it was a bit stressful. And then Peter Gabriel left to go. He got off to work on a film, and then he came back, and that didn't happen. And it was just, I mean, I think quite a stressful time for them all, really.
Yeah,
and that hurts, actually. I don't like to think of them, you know, in that kind of...
Yeah, they all had personal problems, I think, at the time. But I went to see this tour, you know.
Did you really?
I have.
Get
the programme. Because he had this big inflatable suit on with inflatable genitalia and arms and stuff. Yeah, and it was a fantastic stage show. I saw it at the end.
How wonderful. Get there.
I'm going to pull the program out in a second, shall
we? Oh, wow.
But, so it was, you know, but great band. Steve Hackett, great guitar player.
I love Genesis, you know. I love the early stuff.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Trick of the Tail, I remember that. And the album cover's very, very, you just know the album, don't you?
Sure is, but it's the end of the show.
I know, I was just looking at the clock then going, no, I don't want to stop. But,
yeah, Fred, anyway, it's been, you know, great today. I've enjoyed it, and... You know, Germany's been great. We've got a gig on Friday, haven't we? Our first acoustic gig.
Yeah, we're travelling up to North Germany. And we're going to be playing at the Culture Cafe. So we're really looking forward to that.
So we'll see you next week.
Yeah. Okay. Catch you later.